"You little bastard," Andrew nodded. His face was red from running, and his eyes full of tears. "Someday, you will beat him, Tony. Someday, you'll beat us all." He waved and went off to work. I didn't feel that I could ever beat the Vitamin Kid, but Andrew must have had a reason for saying that. I looked across the bridge, and Samuel was starting across. I waited for him, and we walked to school together. "Samuel," I asked, "where does the kid live?" "The kid is my brother," Samuel said softly. I didn't know if he was kidding or not, but we never talked about it again. That year, we waited for the world to end. Each day the rumor spread farther and wider until all the kids were looking at the calendar and waiting for the day. "It'll be in fire," one would say. "It'll be in water," another would argue. "It's in the Bible, my father said." The days grew heavy and ominous. Nobody seemed to know except the kids that the world was coming to an end. During recess, we gathered in the playground and talked about it. We talked about the signs we had seen. Bones even said he had talked to people from a ship from space. We looked at the clouds and waited. We prayed. Fear grew. Then the day came and was gone, and it was kind of disappointing that the world didn't end. Then everybody just said, "See, I told you so." And that year, Bones had a wild fit and busted Willie's head open with a big jar of paste. It was too bad, because after that, not too many of us ate the sweet-tasting paste. That year, a pissing contest was held behind the schoolhouse, and Horse won, but the principal found out about it, and all the pissers in the contest got spanked. George got to burping in class. He could burp any time he wanted to. He would just go, "Ugh." Then he could do variations with it. Pop, pop, pop. He would do it in girls' ears and get socked every time. But he didn't mind. He was kind of crazy, like Bones. And that year, I learned to read and write. Miss Maestas was very pleased with me. On the last day of school, she handed out report cards to the other kids. But when it came to me, she took me to the principal's office. He explained to me that I was a little older than the other kids in first grade, and that my progress had been very good. Miss Maestas beamed. So instead of passing me from first to second, he was passing me from first to third. "What do you think of that?" he smiled. "Thank you, sir," I said. I was very happy. My mother would be proud of me. And that meant that next year I would be in the same grade as the rest of the gang. "Your mother will be very pleased," Miss Maestas said. She kissed my cheek. "Yes," I said. The principal handed me my report card and a piece of paper. "That will explain everything to your parents," he said. He shook my hand like man to man, and he said, "Good luck." There was magic in the letters, and I had been eager to learn the secret. "Thank you, sir," I said. The rest of the day we were like goats held by hobbles. At the end of the day, some of the mothers planned a party for our class, but I didn't feel like staying because I still felt apart from them, and my mother wouldn't be there. I thanked Miss Maestas for her help, and when the last bell rang, I ran home. The freedom of the summer raced with my footsteps as I worked my way through the sweaty, swarming mob of kids. "School is over! School is over!" was on every tongue. The buses honked nervously for their kids. I waved, and the farm kids waved back. We would see each other next fall. By the seesaws, a fight had started, but I didn't want to waste time watching it.
"Wah!"
The cry split the air. The vatos from Los Jaros ran by. I raced after them, but cut off at Allen's, past the Longhorn Saloon, cut past Rosie's, and to the bridge. I started across the bridge, and it was the first time I ever remember talking to it. I sang a song in my mind. Oh, beautiful bridge, I cross you and leave the town. I cross towards the Llano. I climb the hill, I race over the goat path, and I am home. I didn't feel it was a silly song. I only felt happy. Tony! Hoofbeats clattered on the concrete, and the hatchet face of the kid passed me by. Pass? Yeah! And he was gone. At the far end of the bridge, he passed Samuel. Samuel! I called. He turned and waited for me. I passed. Did you? Oh, yes, he smiled. Those teachers keep passing us right along, he said. Samuel was only in the third grade, but he always seemed wise and old when he talked, kind of like my grandfather. But I passed to the third grade. Next year I'll be in class with you, I bragged. Good, he said. Let's go fishing. Now? Sure. Usually, I only thought of fishing on weekends, but it was true that school was over. The first runoff was just subsiding in the river. There should be a lot of hungry catfish waiting for us. No line, I said. I have some, he said. I thought of my mother. I always went straight home after school, but today I had something to celebrate. I was growing up and becoming a man, and suddenly I realized that I could make decisions. Sure, I said. We turned right towards the railroad bridge. I never came up this way. Farther up were the cliffs where Hassan's Indian lived. We passed under the dark shadow of the gigantic railroad bridge. There is evil here, Samuel said. He pointed to a clear plastic balloon beside the path. I didn't know why that was evil. Hee-hee-ha-ha! Frightening, wild laughter filled the air. I froze in my tracks. I thought that surely here in the dark shadow of this bridge La Llorona lurked. Hi! I cried. I must have jumped, because Samuel put his hand on my shoulder and smiled. He pointed up. I looked up at the black girders of the huge bridge and saw a figure scamper precariously from perch to perch. I thought it was the kid. Is he crazy? I asked Samuel. Samuel only smiled. He is my brother, he answered. He led me out of the shadow of the bridge and far away from it. We walked to the bank of the river where Samuel had some line and hooks hidden. We cut some tamarisk branches for poles and dug worms for bait. You fish a lot? I asked. I've always been a fisherman, he answered, as long as I can remember. You fish, he said. Yes. I learned to fish with my brothers when I was very little. Then they went to war and I couldn't fish anymore. Then Ultima came. I paused. I know, he said. So, last summer I fished, sometimes with Hassan. You have a lot to learn. Yes, I answered. The afternoon sun was warm on the sand. The muddy waters after the flood churned listlessly south, and out of the deep hole by the rock in front of us, the catfish came. They were biting good for the first fishing of summer. We caught plenty of channel catfish and a few small yellow bellies. Have you ever fished for the carp of the river? The river was full of big brown carp. It was called the River of the Carp. Everybody knew it was bad luck to fish for the big carp that the summer floods washed downstream. After every flood, when the swirling, angry waters of the river subsided, the big fish could be seen fighting their way back upstream. It had always been so. The waters would subside very fast, and in places, the water would be so low that, as the carp swam back upstream, the backs of the fish would raise a furrow in the water. Sometimes the townspeople came to stand on the bridge and watch the struggle as the carp splashed their way back to the pools from which the flood had uprooted them. Some of the town kids, not knowing it was bad luck to catch the carp, would scoop them out of the low waters and toss the fish upon the sandbars. There, the poor carp would flop until they dried out and died. Then later, the crows would swoop down and eat them. Some people in town would even buy the carp for a nickel and eat the fish. That was very bad. Why, I didn't know. It was a beautiful sight to behold, the struggle of the carp to regain his abode before the river dried to a trickle and trapped him in strange pools of water. What was beautiful about it was that you knew that against all the odds, some of the carp made it back and raised their families, because every year the drama was repeated. "No," I answered. "I don't fish for carp. It's bad luck." "Do you know why?" he asked, and raised an eyebrow. "No," I said, and held my breath. I felt I sat on the banks of an undiscovered river, whose churning, muddied waters carried many secrets. "I'll tell you a story," Samuel said after a long silence. "A story that was told to my father by Hassan's Indian." I listened breathlessly. The lapping of the water was like the tide of time sounding on my soul. "A long time ago, when the earth was young and only wandering tribes touched the virgin grasslands and drank from the pure streams, a strange people came to this land. They were sent to this valley by their gods. They had wandered lost for many years, but never had they given up faith in their gods, and so they were finally rewarded. This fertile valley was to be their home. There were plenty of animals to eat, strange trees that bore sweet fruit, sweet water to drink, and for their fields of maize..." "Were they Indians?" I asked, when he paused. "They were the people," he answered simply, and went on. "There was only one thing that was withheld from them, and that was the fish called the carp. This fish made his home in the waters of the river, and he was sacred to the gods. For a long time the people were happy. Then came the 40 years of the sun without rain, and crops withered and died, the game was killed, and the people went hungry. To stay alive, they finally caught the carp of the river and ate them." I shivered. I had never heard a story like this one. It was getting late, and I thought of my mother. "The gods were very angry. They were going to kill all of the people for their sin. But one kind god who truly loved the people argued against it, and the other gods were so moved by his love that they relented from killing the people. Instead, they turned the people into carp and made them live forever in the waters of the river." The setting sun glistened on the brown waters of the river and turned them to bronze. "It's a sin to catch them," Samuel said. "It's a worse offense to eat them. They are part of the people." He pointed towards the middle of the river, where two huge back fins rose out of the water and splashed upstream. "And if you eat one," I whispered, "you might be punished, like they were punished." "I don't know," Samuel said. He rose and took my fishing line. "Is that all the story?" I asked. He divided the catfish we had caught and gave me my share on a small string. "No, there's more," he said. He glanced around as if to make sure we were alone. Do you know about the golden carp? He asked in a whisper. No, I shook my head. When the gods had turned the people into carp, the one kind god who loved the people grew very sad. The river was full of dangers to the new fish, so he went to the other gods and told them that he chose to be turned into a carp and swim in the river where he could take care of his people. The gods agreed, but because he was a god, they made him very big and colored him the color of gold. And they made him the lord of all the waters of the valley. The golden carp, I said to myself. A new god? I could not believe this strange story, and yet I could not disbelieve Samuel. Is the golden carp still here? Yes, Samuel answered. His voice was strong with faith. It made me shiver. Not because it was cold, but because the roots of everything I had ever believed in seemed shaken. If the golden carp was a god, who was the man on the cross? The Virgin? Was my mother praying to the wrong god? Where? I wanted to know. It is very late, Samuel said. You've learned a lot today. This summer, Siko will find you and take you to the golden carp. And with a swish of branches, he disappeared into the dusk. Samuel! I called. Only silence. I had heard Siko's name mentioned before. He was a town boy, but he didn't hang out with them. They said he spent all his time along the river fishing. I turned homeward in the gathering dusk, full of wonder at the strange story Samuel had told me. Tony! Someone called. I broke into a run and didn't stop until I got home. When I got home, my mother was very angry with me. I had never been late before.
Nuestra Señora de Guadalupe, I have been crazy with worry about you, she cried.
I showed her my promotion, and her feelings changed quickly.
Grande! Deborah, Teresa! Come quick! Tony has been promoted 2 grades. Oh, I knew he would be a man of learning. Maybe a priest!
She crossed herself and sobbed as she held me tightly. Ultima was very happy, too. This one learns as much in 1 day as most do in a year, she smiled. I wondered if she knew about the golden carp. We must pray to the Virgin, my mother said. And although Deborah objected, saying nobody prayed for a grade promotion, my mother gathered us around the Virgin's altar. My father arrived home late from work and was hungry. We were still praying, and supper was late. He was angry. Yes. The summer came and burned me brown with its energy, and the Llano and the river filled me with their beauty. The story of the golden carp continued to haunt my dreams. I went to Samuel's house, but it was boarded up. A neighbor, an old lady, told me that Samuel and his father had taken a job sheep herding for the rest of the summer. My only other avenue to the golden carp would be Siko. So every day I fished along the river and watched and waited. Andrew worked all day, so I didn't see him much, but it was reassuring at least to have him home. Leon and Jean hardly ever wrote. Ultima and I worked in the garden every morning, struggling against the Llano to rescue good earth in which to plant. We spoke little, but we shared a great deal. In the afternoons, I was free to roam along the river or in the blazing hills of the Llano. My father was dejected about his son's leaving, and he drank more than before. And my mother was also unhappy. That was because one of her brothers, my uncle Lucas, was sick. I heard them whispering at night that my uncle had been bewitched. A bruja had put a curse on him. He had been sick all winter, and he had not recovered with the coming of the spring. Now, he was on his deathbed. My other uncles had tried everything to cure their youngest brother, but the doctor in town, and even the great doctor in Las Vegas, had been powerless to cure him. Even the holy priest at El Puerto had been asked to exorcise El Encanto, the curse, and he had failed. It was truly the work of a bruja that was slowly killing my uncle. I heard them say, late at night, when they thought I was asleep, that my uncle Lucas had seen a group of witches do their evil dance for El Diablo, and that is why he had been cursed. In the end, it was decided to hire the help of a curandera, and they came to Ultima for help. It was a beautiful morning when the yucca buds were opening and the mockingbirds were singing on the hill that my Uncle Pedro drove up. I ran to meet him. Antonio! He shook my hand and hugged me, as was the custom.
Buenos días le de Dios, tío,
I answered. We walked into the house where my mother and Ultima greeted him.
How is my papa?
She asked, and served him coffee. My Uncle Pedro had come to seek the help of Ultima, and we all knew it. But there was a prescribed ceremony they had to go through.
He is well. He sends his love, my uncle said, and looked at Ultima.
And my brother, Lucas?
Aye, my uncle shrugged despairingly. He is worse than when you saw him last. We are at the end of our rope. We don't know what to do.
My poor brother, Lucas, my mother cried. That this should happen to the youngest. He has such skill in his hands. His gift with the care and grafting of trees is unsurpassed.
They both sighed.
Have you consulted a specialist?
She asked.
Even to the great doctor in Las Vegas we took him. To no avail, my uncle said.
Did you go to the priest?
My mother asked.
The priest came and blessed the house. But you know that priest at El Puerto. He doesn't want to pit his power against those brujas. He washes his hands of the whole matter.
My uncle spoke as if he knew the witches who cursed Lucas. And I also wondered, why doesn't the priest fight against the evil of the brujas? He has the power of God, the Virgin, and all the saints of the Holy Mother Church behind him.
Is there no one we can turn to?
My mother exclaimed. She and my uncle glanced at Ultima, who had remained quiet, and listened to their talk. Now, she stood up and faced my uncle.
Ay, Pedro Luna, you are like an old lady who sits and talks and wastes valuable time.
You will go,
he smiled triumphantly.
Gracias a Dios, my mother cried.
She ran to Ultima and hugged her.
I will go with one understanding, Ultima cautioned.
She raised her finger and pointed at both of them. The gaze of her clear eyes held them transfixed.
You must understand that when anybody, bruja or curandera, priest or sinner, tampers with the fate of a man, that sometimes a chain of events is set into motion over which no one will have ultimate control. You must be willing to accept this responsibility.
My uncle looked at my mother. Their immediate concern was to save Lucas from the jaws of death. For that, they would accept any responsibility.
I will accept that responsibility on behalf of all my brothers, my Uncle Pedro intoned.
And I accept your help on behalf of my family, my mother added.
Very well, Ultima nodded. I will go and cure your brother.
She went out of the kitchen to prepare the herbs and oils she would need to effect her cure. As she passed me, she whispered,
Be ready, Juan.
I didn't understand what she meant. Juan was my middle name, but it was never used.
Ave Maria Purissima,
my mother said, and slumped into a chair.
She will cure Lucas.
The curse is deep and strong,
my uncle brooded.
Ultima is stronger,
my mother said. I have seen her work miracles. She learned from the greatest healer of all time, the flying man from Las Pasturas.
Aye, my uncle nodded.
Even he acknowledged the great power of the Ancient One from Las Pasturas.
But tell me, who laid the evil curse?
My mother asked.
It was the daughters of Tenorio,
my uncle said.
Ay, those evil brujas.
My mother crossed her forehead, and I followed suit. It was not wise to mention the names of witches without warding off their evil with the sign of the Holy Cross.
Ay, Lucas told Papa the story after he took sick. But it is not until now that we have to resort to a curandera that our father made the story known to us. It was in the bad month of February that Lucas crossed the river to look for a few stray milk cows that had wandered away. He met Manuelito, Alfredo's boy. You know the one that married the lame girl? Anyway, Manuelito told him he had seen the cows moving toward the bend of the river, where the cottonwoods make a thick bosque, the evil place.
Again, my mother made the sign of the cross.
Manuelito said he tried to turn the cows back, but they were already too near that evil place and he was afraid. He tried to warn Lucas to stay away from that place. Dusk was falling, and there were evil signs in the air. The owls were crying to the early horned moon.
Ay, Dios mío!
My mother exclaimed.
But Lucas did not take Manuelito's warning to wait until the next morning. And besides our papa, Manuelito was the last person Lucas spoke to. Ay, that Lucas is so thick-headed and so full of courage. He spurred his horse into the brush of the evil place.
He paused for my mother to serve him fresh coffee.
I still remember when we were children, watching the evil fires dance in that same place,
my mother said.
Aye, my uncle agreed. And that is what Lucas saw that night, except he was not sitting across the river like we used to. He dismounted and crept up to a clearing from where the light of the fireballs shone. He drew near and saw that it was no natural fire he witnessed, but rather the dance of the witches. They bounded among the trees, but their fire did not burn the dry brush.
Ave Maria Purissima,
my mother cried. I had heard many stories of people who had seen the bright balls of fire. These fireballs were brujas on their way to their meeting places. There, it was said, they conducted the black mass in honor of the devil, and the devil appeared and danced with them.
Aye. And there were many other forms the witches took. Sometimes they traveled as coyotes or owls.
Only last summer the story was told that at Cuervo, a rancher had shot a coyote. He and his sons had followed the trail of blood to the house of an old woman of the village. There, they found the old woman dead of a gunshot wound. The rancher swore that he had etched a cross on his bullet, and that proved that the old woman was a witch. And so, he was let free. Under the old law, there was no penalty for killing a witch.
When he was up close, my uncle continued, Lucas saw that the fireballs began to acquire a form. Three women dressed in black appeared. They made a fire in the center of the clearing. One produced a pot, and another an old rooster. They beheaded the rooster and poured its blood into the pot. Then they began to cook it, throwing in many other things while they danced and chanted their incantations. Lucas did not say what it was they cooked, but he said it made the most awful stench he had ever smelled.
"The black mass," my mother gasped.
"See," my uncle nodded. He paused to light a cigarette and refill his cup of coffee. Lucas said they poured sulfur on the coals of the fire, and that the flames rose up in devilish fashion. It must have been a sight to turn the blood cold, the dreariness of the wind and the cold night, the spot of ground so evil and so far from Christian help.
"Yes, yes," my mother urged. "And then what happened?"
The story had held us both spellbound.
"Well, you know Lucas. He could see the evil one himself and not be convinced. He thought the three witches were three old dirty women who deserved a Christian lashing, tongue or otherwise. So he stepped forth from behind the tree that hid him, and he challenged them."
"No," my mother gasped.
"See," my uncle nodded.
"And if I know Lucas, he probably said something like, 'Oye, you ugly brujas, prepare to meet a Christian soul.'"
I was astounded at the courage of my Uncle Lucas. No one in his right mind would confront the cohorts of the devil.
It was then he recognized the Trementina sisters, Tenorio's three girls.
"Ay, Dios mío,"
my mother cried.
"Ay. They have always been rumored to be brujas. They were very angry to be caught performing their devilish mass. He said they screamed like furies and were upon him, attacking him like wild animals. But he did the right thing. While he was behind the tree, he had taken two dead branches and quickly tied them together with a shoelace. He made a rude cross with the two sticks. Now he held up the holy cross in the face of those evil women and cried out, 'Jesús, María y José!' At the sight of the cross and at the sound of those holy words, the three sisters fell to the ground in a fit of agony and pain. They rolled on the ground like wounded animals until he lowered the cross. Then they picked themselves up and fled into the darkness, cursing him as they went." Everything was silent then. Only Lucas remained by the light of the dying fire at that cursed spot. He found his frightened horse by the river, mounted it, and returned home. He told the story only to Papa, who admonished him not to repeat it. But within the week, Lucas was stricken. He speaks only to mutter of the revenge the Trementina sisters took on him for discovering their secret ceremony. The rest of the time, his mouth is clamped so tight, he cannot eat. He wastes away. He is dying.
They were silent for a long time, each one thinking about the evil thing that befell their brother.
"But didn't you go to Tenorio?"
my mother asked.
"Papa was against it. He wouldn't believe in this witchcraft thing. But Juan and Pablo and myself went to Tenorio and confronted him. But we couldn't charge him with anything because we had no proof. He only laughed at us and told us he was within his right to shoot us if we made an accusation against him without proof. And he had his ring of coyotes around him in the saloon. He said he had witnesses if we tried anything, and so we had to leave. He laughed at us."
"Ay, he is an evil man," my mother shuddered.
"Evil begets evil,"
my uncle said. His wife was known to make clay dolls and prick them with needles. She made many people of the valley sick. Some died from her curses. She paid for her sins, but not before she delivered 3 brujas to carry on her work in our peaceful valley. I am ready, Ultima interrupted. I turned to see her standing, watching us. She carried only her small black satchel. She was dressed in black, and her headscarf crossed over her face so that only her bright eyes shone. She bore herself with dignity, and although she was very small, she was ready to do battle with all the terrible evil about which I had just heard.
Grande,
my mother went to her and hugged her. It is such a difficult task we ask you to do, but you are our last hope. Ultima remained motionless.
Evil is not easy to destroy, she said. One needs all the help one can get.
She looked at me, and her gaze made me step forward.
The boy will have to go with me, she whispered.
What?
My mother was startled.
Antonio must go with me. I have need of him,
Ultima repeated softly.
I will go, I said. But why?
My mother asked. My uncle answered the question.
He is a Juan.
Ay.
And he has strong Luna blood.
Ave Maria Purissima,
my mother muttered.
It must be so if you want your brother cured, Ultima decreed.
My mother looked at her brother. My uncle only shrugged.
Whatever you say, Grande,
my mother said.
It will be good for Anthony to see his uncles.
He does not go to visit,
Ultima said solemnly.
I will prepare some clothing.
He must go as he is, Ultima said.
She turned to me.
Do you want to help your uncle, Antonio?
She asked.
Yes,
I replied.
It will be hard, she said.
I do not mind, I answered. I want to help.
And if people say you walk in the footsteps of a curandera, will you be ashamed?
No. I will be proud, Ultima,
I said emphatically. She smiled.
Come, we waste precious time.
My uncle and I followed her outside and into the truck. Thus began our strange trip.
Adios, my mother called. Cuidado. Saludos a papá y a todos. Adios. Adios,
I called. I turned and waved goodbye. The drive to El Puerto was always a pleasant one, but today it was filled with strange portents. Across the river, where lonely farms dotted the hills, whirlwinds and dust devils darkened the horizon. I had never seen anything like it. We seemed to travel a sea of calmness, but all around the sky darkened. And when we arrived at the village, we saw the horned day moon fixed exactly between the 2 dark mesas at the southern end of the valley.
The moon of the lunas,
my uncle remarked, breaking the silence of the entire trip.
It is a good sign,
Ultima nodded.
That is why they call this place El Puerto de la Luna, she said to me, because this valley is the door through which the moon of each month passes on its journey from the east to the west.
So it was fitting that these people, the Lunas, came to settle in this valley. They planted their crops and cared for their animals according to the cycles of the moon. They lived their lives, sang their songs, and died under the changing moon. The moon was their goddess. But why was the weather so strange today? And why had Ultima brought me? I wanted to help, but how was I to help? Just because my name was Juan? And what was it about my innocent Luna blood that was to help lift the curse from my uncle? I didn't know then, but I was to find out. A dust trail followed the truck down the dusty street. It was deathly quiet in El Puerto. Not even the dogs barked at the truck. And the men of the village were not working in the fields. They clung together in groups at the adobe corners of houses and whispered to each other as we drove by. My uncle drove straight to my grandfather's house. No one came to the truck for a long time, and my uncle grew nervous. Women in black passed silently in and out of the house. We waited. Finally, my grandfather appeared. He walked slowly across the dirt patio and greeted Ultima. "Médica," he said, "I have a son who is dying." "Abuelo," she answered, "I have a cure for your son." He smiled and reached through the open window to touch her hand. "It is like the old days," he said. "We still have the power to fight this evil," she nodded. "I will pay you in silver if you save my son's life," he said. He seemed unaware of me or my uncle. It seemed a ceremony they performed. $40 to cheat la muerte," she mumbled. "Agreed," he responded. He looked around to the nearby houses where, through parted curtains, curious eyes watched. "The people of the pueblo are nervous. It has been many years since a curandera came to cure." "Farmers should be farming," Ultima said simply. "Now, I have work to do." She stepped out of the truck. "What will you need?" my grandfather asked. "You know," she said, "a small room, bed sheets, water, stove, atole to eat." "I will prepare everything myself," he said. "There are women already mourning in the house," Ultima said, and gathered her shawl around her head. "Get rid of them." "As you say," my grandfather answered. I didn't think he liked to empty his house of his son's wives, but he knew that when a curandera was working a cure, she was in charge. "There will be animals sniffing around the house at night. The coyotes will howl at your door. Inform your sons that no shots are to be fired. I will deal with those who come to spoil the cure myself." My grandfather nodded. "Will you enter my house now?" he asked. "No. I must first speak to Tenorio. Is he in his dog hole, that place he calls a saloon?" she asked. My grandfather said yes. "I will speak to him," Ultima said. "I will first try to reason with him. He must know that those who tamper with fate are often swallowed by their own contrivance." "I will send Pedro and Juan with you," my grandfather began, but she interrupted him. "Since when does a curandera need help to deal with dogs?" she retorted. "Come, Antonio," she called, and started down the street. I scurried after her. "The boy is necessary?" my grandfather called.
He is necessary, she answered. You are not afraid, are you, Antonio? She asked me.
No,
I answered and took her hand. Many hidden eyes followed our progress up the dusty, vacant street. The saloon was at the end of the street and opposite the church. It was a small, run-down adobe house with a sign over the entrance. The sign said the saloon belonged to Tenorio Trementina. This man, who doubled as the villager's barber on Saturdays, had a heart as black as the pit of hell. Ultima didn't seem to fear him, nor the evil powers of his three daughters. Without hesitation, she pushed her way through the doorway, and I followed in her wake. There were four men huddled around one of the few tables. Three turned and looked at Ultima with surprise written in their eyes. They hadn't expected her to come into this place of evil. The fourth one kept his back to us, but I saw his hunched shoulders tremble.
I seek Tenorio,
Ultima announced. Her voice was strong and confident. She stood tall, with a nobleness to her stature that I had seen often when we walked on the Llano. She was not afraid, and so I tried to stand like her and put my fears out of my heart.
What do you want, bruja?
The man who wouldn't face us snarled.
Give me your face, Ultima demanded. Have you not the strength to face an old woman? Why do you keep your back to me?
The thin, hunched body jumped up and spun around. I think I jumped at the sight of his face. It was thin and drawn, with tufts of beard growing on it. The eyes were dark and narrow. An evil glint emanated from them. The thin lips trembled when he snarled.
Because you are a bruja.
Spots of saliva curled at the edges of the mouth. Ultima laughed.
Ay, Tenorio, she said. You are as ugly as your dark soul.
It was true. I had never seen an uglier man.
Toma!
Tenorio shouted. He crossed his fingers and held the sign of the cross in front of Ultima's face. She did not budge. Tenorio gasped and drew back, and his three cronies pushed their chairs to the floor and backed away. They knew that the sign of the cross would work against any bruja, but it had not worked against Ultima. Either she was not a bruja, or to their way of thinking, she had powers that belonged to the devil himself.
I am a curandera, Ultima said softly, and I have come to lift a curse. It is your daughters who do evil that are the brujas. You lie, vieja,
he shouted. I thought he would attack Ultima, but his gnarled body only trembled with anger. He could not find the courage to touch her.
Tenorio.
It was Ultima who now spoke sternly.
You are a fool if you do not heed my words. I did not need to come to you, but I did. Listen to my words of reason. Tell your daughters to lift the curse. Lies!
He screamed as if in pain. He turned to the three men he had depended upon to act as witnesses, but they did not protest on his behalf. They nervously glanced at each other and then at Ultima.
I know when and where the curse was laid, Ultima continued. I know when Lucas came to your shop for a drink and to have his hair clipped by your evil shears. I know that your daughters gathered the cut hair, and with that, they worked their evil work.
It was more than the three men could stand. They were frightened. They lowered their eyes to avert Tenorio's gaze and scurried for the door. The door banged shut. A strange, dark whirlwind swept through the dusty street and cried mournfully around the corner of the saloon. The storm which had been around us broke, and the rising dust seemed to shut off the light of the sun. It grew dark in the room.
Ay, bruja, Tenorio threatened with his fist. For what you have said to shame my daughters and my good name in front of those men, I will see you dead.
His voice was harsh and ominous. His evil eyes glared at Ultima.
I do not fear your threats, Tenorio, Ultima said calmly. You well know, my powers were given to me by El Hombre Volador.
At the mention of this great healer from Las Pasturas, Tenorio drew back as if slapped in the face by an invisible power.
I thought I could reason with you, Ultima continued. I thought you would understand the powers at work and how they can wreck the destinies of many lives. But I see it is useless. Your daughters will not lift the curse, and so I must work the magic beyond evil, the magic that endures forever.
And my three daughters? Tenorio cried.
They choose to tamper with fate, Ultima answered. Pity the consequence.
She took my hand, and we walked out into the street. The choking dust was so thick that it shut out the sun. I was used to dust storms of early spring, but this one in the middle of summer was unnatural. The wind moaned and cried, and in the middle of the sky the sun was a blood-red dot. I put one hand to my eyes, and with the other I gripped Ultima tightly as we struggled against the wind. I was thinking about the evil Tenorio and how Ultima had made him cower when I heard the hoofbeats. If I had been alone, I would have paid no heed to them. So concerned was I with finding some direction in the strange dust storm. But Ultima was more alert than I. With a nimble sidestep and a pull, she jerked me from the path of the black horse and rider that went crashing by us. The rider that had almost run us down disappeared into the swirling dust.
Tenorio, Ultima shouted in my ear. He is hurrying home to warn his daughters. Beware of his horse, she added. He has trained it to trample and kill.
I realized how close I had been to injury or death. As we approached my grandfather's house, there was a lull in the storm. The sky remained dark around us, but the clouds of dust abated somewhat. The women who were already in mourning for my Uncle Lucas took this opportunity to place their mantas over their faces and to scurry to their homes before the hellish storm raised its head again. It was very strange to see the women in black hurrying out of the house and into the howling storm. It was like seeing death leaving a body. We hurried into the house. The door slammed behind us. In the dark, my grandfather was waiting.
I grew worried, he said. Is everything ready? Ultima asked. As you ordered, he said, and led us through the dark, quiet rooms of the house.
The flickering lantern he held cast our dancing shadows on the smooth, clean adobe walls. I had never seen the house quiet and empty like it was today. Always there were my uncles and aunts and cousins to greet. Now, it was like a quiet tomb. Far in the deep recesses of the long house, we came to a small room. My grandfather stood at the door and motioned. We entered the simple room. It had a dirt floor packed down from many water sprinklings, and its walls were smooth plastered adobe. But the good clean earth of the room did not wash away or filter the strong smell of death in the room. The wooden bed in the room held the shrunken body of my dying Uncle Lucas. He was sheathed in white, and I thought he was already dead. He didn't seem to breathe. His eyes were two dark pits, and the thin parchment of yellow skin clung to his bony face like dry paper. Ultima went to him and touched his forehead.
Lucas,
she whispered. There was no answer. He has been like this for weeks now, my grandfather said. Beyond hope. There were tears in his eyes. Life is never beyond hope, Ultima nodded.
Aye,
my grandfather agreed. He straightened his stooped shoulders. I have brought everything you ordered. He nodded towards the small stove and pile of wood. There was clean linen on the chair next to the stove, and on the shelf there was water, atole meal, sugar, milk, kerosene, and other things. The men have been instructed about the animals. The women in mourning have been sent away. I will wait outside the room. If you need anything, I will be waiting. There must be no interference, Ultima said. She was already removing her shawl and rolling up her sleeves. I understand, my grandfather said. His life is in your hands. He turned and walked out, closing the door after him.
Antonio, make a fire,
Ultima commanded. She lit the kerosene lantern while I made the fire. Then she burned some sweet incense. With the crackling warmth of the fire and the smell of purifying incense, the room seemed less of a sepulcher. Outside, the storm roared and dark night came. We warmed water in a large basin, and Ultima bathed my uncle. He was like a rag doll in her hands. I felt great pity for my uncle. He was the youngest of my uncles, and I always remembered him full of life and bravado. Now his body was a thin skeleton held together by dry skin, and on his face was written the pain of the curse. At first, the sight of him made me sick, but as I helped Ultima, I forgot about that, and I took courage.
Will he live?
I asked her, while she covered him with fresh sheets.
They let him go too long, she said. It will be a difficult battle.
But why didn't they call you sooner?
I asked.
The church would not allow your grandfather to let me use my powers. The church was afraid that...
She didn't finish, but I knew what she would have said. The priest at El Puerto did not want the people to place much faith in the powers of La Curandera. He wanted the mercy and faith of the church to be the villagers' only guiding light.
Would the magic of Ultima be stronger than all the powers of the saints and the Holy Mother Church?
I wondered. Ultima prepared her first remedy. She mixed kerosene and water and carefully warmed the bowl on the stove. She took many herbs and roots from her black bag and mixed them into the warm, oily water. She muttered as she stirred her mixture, and I did not catch all of what she said, but I did hear her say,
"The curse of the Trementinas shall bend and fly in their faces. We shall test the young blood of the Lunas against the old blood of the past."
When she was done, she cooled the remedy. Then, with my help, we lifted my uncle and forced the mixture down his throat. He groaned in pain and convulsed as if he wanted to throw up the medicine. It was encouraging to see signs of life in him, but it was difficult to get him to keep the medicine down.
"Drink, Lucas,"
she coaxed him, and when he clamped his teeth shut, she pried them open and made him drink. Howls of pain filled the small room. It was very frightening, but at length we got the medicine down. Then we covered him, because he began sweating and shivering at the same time. His dark eyes looked at us like a captured animal. Then finally, they closed, and the fatigue made him sleep.
Ay, Ultima said. We have begun our cure.
She turned and looked at me, and I could tell she was tired.
Are you hungry?
She smiled.
No,
I replied. I had not eaten since breakfast, but the things that had happened had made me forget my hunger.
Still,
we had better eat, she said. It might be the last meal we will have for a few days. They had his fresh clipped hair to work with. The curse is very strong, and his strength is gone. Lay your blankets there, and make yourself a bed, while I fix us some atole.
I spread the blankets close to the wall and near the stove, while Ultima prepared the atole.
My grandfather had brought sugar and cream and 2 loaves of fresh bread, so we had a good meal.
This is good, I said.
I looked at my uncle.